Good morning or good afternoon. This is Françoise Mathieu, and I would like to welcome you to A Chat with Pat. I'm here. I will be your host today alongside my dear colleague and friend, Dr. Patricia Fisher. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Françoise, and to everyone who's joining us today.
We are actually from sea to sea. I am on the East Coast, and you're on the West Coast today. Is that correct?
Actually, yes. I'm in Anacortes, Washington, as we speak.
Oh, well, I'm sure the weather is nicer there than it is in Canada. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to tell you folks a little bit about Pat and I, and then we'll get going. And just a reminder, this is being recorded, so if you have folks who were hoping to join in or to hear it, that will be available after the fact as well. So first, a little bit about us. Dr. Patricia Fisher and myself are the co-executive directors of TEND. We're mental health professionals, and we're experts in high-stress, trauma-exposed work environments. Along with our team, we provide education, training, and consulting to organizations and professionals who work in complex work environments such as healthcare, child welfare, law enforcement, community mental health, and many others in related fields. If you're new to the work of TEND, please visit our website, and the address is TEND Academy, that's all one word, T-E-N-D Academy, .ca or .com. Today we're here to discuss Pat's newest book, which was launched, published actually in December, and it is called Resilience, Balance, and Meaning, Supporting Our Lives and Our Work in High-Stress, Trauma-Exposed Workplaces. It is a treasure trove of resources, of self-assessment tools. It's just absolutely wonderful, and in my opinion, it was such a needed resource in our field. And we're here basically to have a conversation and to also answer any questions that you may have. But first, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping, let you know about a couple of things. So Pat and I will have about a 30-minute discussion, and we're then going to open it up to Q&A. If you're listening to this during the live broadcast, you're going to see that you can enter questions in the Q&A box on the web. Please type your questions at any point during the talk, and I will tally them up and we'll pose them to Pat, and Pat will reply to them at the end of the call. Please also note that there's a 17-second delay for us to receive your questions, so type them as soon as you have a question so that we avoid a gap at the end during our Q&A. As promised, we will be holding a draw for a free copy of Resilience, Balance, and Meaning today, and we will announce the winner at the end of the call. If you're interested in purchasing Pat's book or any other products that we have, such as web courses and other books, please visit our website and click on Books for Pat's new product. So now, with no further ado, let's begin. So, Pat, I was wanting to start by kind of a bigger conversation about what led you to write this book. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey? Why did you write it, and what gap do you feel that it was filling?
Thanks, François. And, of course, this is one of those really huge questions, and so I'm going to try and boil it down a little. And as you know, I've been very much active in the whole field of trauma exposure for, oh, gosh, over 30 years now. And in that, have been a specialist working with victims, with offenders, inpatient, outpatient, wider systems, white papers, research, everything that one can do. And in that, of course, have seen and witnessed the whole growth of the field of traumatology. When I first began working in this field with my own graduate work, that was at a time when the psychiatric textbooks that medical students had were still saying that incest only happens in 1 in 10,000 families. Mm-hmm. So you can see that the field has changed so massively over this last 25 years. And in that, I've had the privilege of being able to work in trauma-exposed systems all across North America and abroad. And what started becoming so evident was the costs and consequences for our people, the people who are working with traumatized populations, with offenders, with all of the systems where people are being exposed to traumatic material either directly or indirectly. And thankfully, there were so many other people paying also attention to this, and hence the rise of the fields and the study of compassion fatigue, secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, and all of those issues, let alone the direct trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But what was really important to me was we have all of that, absolutely, and wonderful research in that, but how it was embedded in the extraordinary sets of changes that were happening in the systems that we were working in, that where we were delivering these services. And so the way that our trauma exposure is embedded in the wiser systemic issues also became extremely important. So I began a whole program of research around that in the very late 90s. And out of that growing the whole complex stress model, where we're looking at both the trauma exposure elements as well as the system-based elements and how these two play back and forth. So out of that, a lot of resource development, assessment tools, you know, on and on it went, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so this last 15 years, there's been a great deal of elaboration of that work. So I think in terms of this particular book, what I'm really concerned about here is how we as individuals working in these systems are best able to proceed, to thrive, to grow, and to be able to address this so that we're not injured, and that when we do get bounced around or run into the really rough stuff, we know how to deal with it. We can get the resources in place. And so as I was thinking about all of this, I think there's a few basic premises that I kind of start with,
mm-hmm.
that are very important to me and behind this book. And first of all, I think my passion in this is that everyone who works in trauma-exposed environments, we're all doing work which is absolutely critical if we're going to have a civil society.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fundamental importance of all of the fields where people are in trauma exposure, healthcare, social services, emergency services, justice sector, corrections, the military, I mean, the list goes on and on. But when you think of every single place where people are, being trauma exposed, those are critical fields that we really need to have. I think another fundamental premise is that there are ways that we can grow in this work that you can't grow in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
People who work in other fields where they don't, touch the meat and gristle of the human condition in the way that we do, are not challenged in the same way to find so much more of a complex understanding of ourselves, our world, how do we intersect with it, that things are a whole lot more complicated than the world most of us were kind of raised in that sort of culture normal view. So I think that, when we work in these fields, that sort of culture normal notion that, sort of at the most simplistic level, which is sort of nice things happen to nice people and bad mm-hmm. things happen to bad people, gets completely blown up. And we learn that really hard and terrible things can happen to wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
We also learn often that people who do really hard things and very damaging things are themselves complex human beings with huge backstories. So we have to grow this much more complex understanding and a much more sophisticated umbrella to be able to hold our experience. But we also know that as we're doing that, it can be a very perilous pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And we know many of us have gotten kind of singy. We've all seen colleagues and friends who've gotten into trouble with this. So we need to do everything we can to help us stay on the more on the growing path and be able to be as embedded in protection, growth, resilience, our own adaptiveness.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to answer. I'm just getting a couple of technical questions, so I want to address that. This is an audio only. There are no slides because some people are asking for visuals. It's an audio recording. I just want to address that. Can I go back to something you just said? I think is so important in terms of the journey, and also, you know, you're referring to the reality that when we go into these fields, you know, any of these high trauma, high stress exposed fields, that very few of us have a true understanding of what we're walking into as rookies.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I think that we have to think about the background stressors that we're working into, or you know, psychological challenges that we don't talk about, we don't know about. And for the most part, too, we're walking into systems which are thankfully changing somewhat, but many of these systems come from a history of looking at any kind of impact of the work on us as being signs of weakness. And many of them sort of have that whole sort of backdrop culture of, you know, sort of can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen, and the suck it up philosophy. And so people were traditionally really barricaded from ever talking about or expressing that they were finding things difficult. So, of course, that in itself becomes very stressful, because then people start feeling shame-based, and, you know, they think it's uniquely about them that they're having troubles. So, you know, we have that background piece. The other piece is when we first walk into this world, I think that by any measure, this is stressful work. It's highly stressful work. So just the backdrop is that, you know, this is pretty darn stressful. And then I think the other part, too, is, you know, again, hugely how you understand yourself, the world, how things work, you know, how that gets so challenged when you find out how all of this plays out. And then I love the construct, too, of emotional labor, because that's another thing. Yeah. So when we first walk into this world, in order to do our job, we have to present in a certain kind of way with our client or the, you know, the recipient of whatever it is we're doing. And so in the beginning, our inside voice, given what we're dealing with, might be saying, oh, my God, and we're freaking out inside. But our outside voice has to be, well, let's see how we're going to deal with this. So that gap, that distance between what it's feeling like, your felt experience, and how you're having to express yourself in order to do your work, that's labor. That's emotional labor. And I think one of the things we often sort of forget about is that as we become so much more experienced, the emotional labor quotient sort of slims down. But for new workers, they're spending a lot of time doing a ton of emotional labor because this stuff's new to them. And I think, again, one of the critical things we always have to be thinking about now is the very high proportion in our workforces of new workers. Because demographically, again, we've been going through this huge transition with the boomers leaving, a great deal of mobility inside of our workforce, and a very high proportion of new workers entering and moving through our systems. So, you know, the reality of these kind of entry pressures for people is much higher than it used to be when we had a much more sort of stable workforce back in the day when, you know, the boomers for about 30 years occupied the vast majority of the workforce. So we've got all of those issues going on. And
can I just interrupt
of course,
you
the
for
other
a second?
Background.
I just, oh,
yeah,
sorry. Can I
sure.
just interrupt you for a second? And we'll go back to the other background that what's going on, because I want to kind of illustrate a couple of real-life examples of what you're speaking of that I just witnessed a couple of weeks ago. I was presenting at a very large agency that works, honestly, I think they do everything except an oil change in this community. Do you know what I mean? Like homeless shelters and addictions and youth and halfway house. And, like, it was incredible. And it was the youngest group I've ever presented to, and I looked across 100 people, and most of them were millennials. And that was a first for me. I mean, these were, without being rude to these staff, they will agree with me that they were, those are entry-level jobs. They were extremely poorly paid. You know, they're not lucrative jobs, mm-hmm. and they were talking about a tremendous amount of mobility and how they were having a really difficult time retaining their staff. So that was one piece.
Absolutely.
The other piece is something you highlighted that I wanted to illustrate with an example. When you talk about emotional labor, it made me think about a group I've been working with quite a bit lately, which are judges. And they, I think, mm-hmm. have kind of an extreme version of that. But, you know, they were talking about having to look and seem completely impassive and neutral while hearing some extremely difficult things, and how they were finding that to be difficult because there was a disconnect between their felt experience and what they need to present.
Absolutely. And of course, you think about the more extreme the material is that people are hearing about or having to work with, and the more critical it is that they appear to be so balanced, so even, so emotionally stabilized, so they're stabilizing those individuals who may be pretty darn distressed. So you can't escalate with that person. And so this is an extremely challenging piece. And I think one of the things that I often hear illustrated with the younger people and the new people is that they see their colleagues doing this who are more experienced, and they think from their colleagues' experience that the colleague isn't at all distressed by it. Mm-hmm. And so then they start feeling really inadequate because they are struggling to try and keep that very calm front. So it's sort of a double whammy. They're doing it, plus they're feeling really inadequate.
No, that's a really great point.
So you can
and
get
all sorts
of layers in there. Yeah.
I took you off course from that. We were talking about kind of the generational shift, and you were talking about also kind of the background piece. I just kind of took you off there. Sorry about that.
Oh, we can go into so many different directions with this.
So you were saying, you were talking about the demographic shift, and you were saying there was another kind of context in which this is happening. Do you mind picking up there?
Sure, and some of the other contextual pieces, and these are the ones that are playing out when we come into this without even really thinking about it, we just live it, is that when you think about all of the work we do, the normative experience we have in trauma-exposed fields, we can't talk about this stuff at Sunday dinner with our relatives and friends. And so there's this whole piece, too, of the isolation that comes with it, because the only people we can talk to are our colleagues and the only people who get it, because we can't talk about this stuff outside, A, because, you know, often there are confidentiality issues, but even more importantly, the content of it could be potentially harmful and distressing. We know how hefty this stuff is. We're not going to talk to our niece or our auntie or somebody who works in a completely different field about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the huge isolation. And the other part, too, sometimes is this kind of stigma by association.
Oh,
and this part's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you, you know, again, sociologically, if you are working with a highly, highly valued social group and providing services to them, people tend to see you in heroic terms. And in some ways, it's kind of isolating because you're overvalued, and they don't really get the normativeness of it. On the other hand, and for many of us who work in trauma-exposed fields, we're working with groups of people who may be socially stigmatized or marginalized. And so you get this kind of stigma by association. And so that's the place where, you know, when you say what it is you do, and people kind of have either a bit of that ooh, ick response, or they have the, ooh, I don't know how you can do that, but I guess somebody has to. And so there's that sort of alienation and marginalization that tends to go with this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a lot of ways, when you look at the kind of psychological hot buttons for anybody who's sort of entering this work and, you know, not even aware that these are going on, but we're living it, is we've got this sort of alienation, we've often got stigma, we've got high levels of stress, we've got isolation, and we've got identity challenge. Our whole view of the self and world is changing. So that's a lot of psychological hot buttons, just for starters, before we get into the specifics of the particular work that we're doing and all the risk and resiliency factors that are embedded in the system-based issues and then the trauma exposure issues.
So in a way, I think that with you know, you seamlessly have kind of addressed, so let me go back for a second. So Pat's book is divided into three sections, and the first chapter, or rather section, is called What is the Challenge? Then you have the piece called Where Am I Now? And then you have the piece about building my wellness plan. And it sounds like, you know, part of what you've been talking about in a way is the piece about what is the challenge, what context are we working in, what is our own capacity, that kind of piece, right?
Yeah. Well, now, think...
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, I think part of that is that as a clinician, I'm still a huge believer behind everything else of, you know, first we have to really understand what's going on before we can come up with useful ways to address it. And so that first section really explores what does the research tell us? And thankfully we have mountains of fabulous research now. In terms of all of the risk and resiliency factors, and there's a host of them, in all of the system-based stressors and in the trauma exposure stressors. So what are they? How does that stuff actually work? How does the neuropsychophysiology of stress exposure work? And, you know, the work particularly in the last 5 years around that has been fabulous. I mean, we understand now how this stuff works in a way that before we only had sort of correlational studies and it was one great big black box. Now we can actually unpack that black box and we know what's going on. That becomes really instructive in terms of how we're actually responding and what are some of the consequences we're finding and what is, again, helpful. And so that first section really, in a very real way, helps you understand how does stuff all work, how does that apply to you. And then the second section is a whole set of self-evaluation tools where you're looking at what is your specific profile right now in terms of risk and resiliency stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And really importantly, given that, what's your self-care story looking like, both in your personal life and in your professional life, in a full 360? And then finally, a whole section of clinically referenced tools around what might be some of the consequences that you may be experiencing right now in relationship to this. So you get a good handle on where are you right now. And again, all of this is designed for repeated use. And then the last part, the final section, is given you get it, you understand where you are, then building your own very specific and very practical wellness plan, both in your work life and in your personal life. And then finally, having built your plan, I think very importantly, is starting to unpack what are some of the barriers for you about actually acting on the plan that you've designed, because we're all going to have a million barriers.
I want to stick with that. Oh, I'm sorry. So I promised Pat, by the way, at the beginning that I will not interrupt her, and I'm going to interrupt her the whole time because I'm French-Canadian. I'm sorry.
Okay. Great stats, don't worry.
So I want to stick with that for a second, Pat, if you don't mind. So you and I get these questions all the time when we go out there doing consulting and keynotes and training. And I'm sure you know the questions that are coming. The questions are, what do we do next? Where do we begin? And we get those questions from leadership, and we also get it from individuals. You know, I understand, which, of course, the understanding piece is huge, and it can be an incredible paradigm shift. I'm not glossing over that at all. But in the interest of time for this short call, I was wondering whether we could shift over to talking a little bit about what are some of the strategies when, for example, let's start with a leader, a manager, a supervisor. When they come to you and they say, where do I start? How do I support my team? What do you say? What do you recommend?
And I'm going to absolutely answer that question. But before I do, there's one thing I want to say.
Yeah.
And that is, as you alluded to, and that's behind everything else, is a paradigm shift. We're looking at a fundamental culture shift around how we view the work that we do and its impact on us in these systems and how we approach it. And I think in many ways it gets summed up by the fundamental equation that shifts. Most of us who come into the helping professions and all of these trauma-exposed professions come in with this cultural baggage that says, either I take care of you or I take care of me. And if I take care of me, then I'm selfish and bad. So if underneath everything else, we typically are all starting with that. Mm-hmm. What we are having to shift to is another equation, and that is, in order to take care of you, I have to take care of me. And I think of that as being like the airline model. I have to put the oxygen mask on myself first in order to still be breathing and able to put masks on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can't underline enough how much we're all pushing back against some pretty powerful socialization that we've all received and haven't even thought about, that we will always put ourselves at the end of the line in terms of taking care of ourselves. So coming back to your question about leaders, I think that one of the first things for leaders, and I have a huge concern for them, and I, as you know, been doing a lot of work in that field lately, is that leaders are people too. And that the first place they have to start is on themselves and what their needs are. And in the same ways we're seeing such high turnover and mobility for everybody in the field, this in some ways gets even amplified and more critical when we're looking at people in leadership, because so many of them are brand new in leadership. They have just kind of been dumped in, sink or swim, and everybody kind of assumes we should know what we're doing. That's not a fair assumption. And also, as leaders are, you know, sort of moving into supervisory roles and increasingly in management roles, they're becoming increasingly isolated. They don't have that peer base that they typically had when they were frontline folks. So I think one of the things with leadership that's so critical is, first of all, they're people too, and what they're modeling in terms of addressing all of the stressors and self-care, et cetera, is really amplified for their staff. It's mm-hmm. incredibly important. What we do is so much more important than what we say. We also are really needing to provide the supports and the training for the leadership, everything from, you know, specific training to meet their needs, to the peer mentoring, peer support groups with other people in leadership roles, get them out of the isolation, because we know that social support is one of the most critical issues.
Okay.
And they really need to have additional supports around understanding the complexity of their situations, because we've got a lot more moving parts than we used to have before. And, of course, leadership is all about relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we call it leadership as opposed to management. And so how they understand and are enabled to work in the relational piece with their peers and with the folks that they're supervising. And all of this inside of an environment typically where there's a ton of high turnover, a lot of mobility, a lot of organizational change, and, you know, they're having to adapt. And I think our leaders are just so critical right now in all these organizations, and I think we're hugely under-resourcing them. And I think for them, we really need to look at what are the sort of supervision and peer supervision and mentoring supports they have, and then in their role as leaders, how they're able to enable good, really good supervision for their staff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the pieces that so often comes up, is, as we both find out, of course, is that we're often still caught in people thinking of models of supervision being like the olden days when we had pretty stable workforces and we'd have one or two, a sprinkling of new people. So you could do that one-on-one supervision. Now, if you're in leadership, chances are you may have 50, 67% of your people who are all either new or relatively new. You can't do one-on-one supervision, or you're not even going to have time to take a lunch break, let alone any of the other things that you have to do in your job. So new models of approaching this in terms of communities of practice, group supervision models, and again, inside of that, you're going to be able to accomplish so much more, because not only are you making sure that everybody in that group is receiving the same messages about how we do what it is we do, but you're forming a group cohesion, you're forming group norms, and it's hugely supportive for everybody who is in that group. And, of course, as that group matures, they become a community of practice. So there's all sorts of strategies.
Yeah. Absolutely. And sorry, I need to interrupt you because I'm aware of the time, how quickly this goes by. It's crazy. And in fact, that conversation is also something you discuss more in your organizational health trainings and your book, Building Resilient Teams. So I'm aware of the time. So we basically have 15 minutes left, including questions. But I think we can actually answer some of the questions we're getting by answering also the question about, top strategies for an individual. You and I both also will get the comment when we go to organizations saying, well, what if I'm not the problem? What if I don't have a good leader or manager? What if I work in a toxic environment? You know, all of those kind of pieces. And we also, I mean, and I think the beauty of this book is also that it offers really concrete tools for individuals who can do it on their own or as a team, but to really begin at a place where there's possibility. What would you suggest for, and it actually ties into a question I just got here. I have several questions here, but if you don't mind, can we weave the questions into this? Is this okay?
Sure.
So a question I'm getting is obviously how do we support the helping professionals, but also how do we care for ourselves? Where do we begin? Mm-hmm. And the other question I got, which I don't think we have time to answer, but I thought it was such an important question that someone asked. I think it's someone who works for Veterans Affairs, and basically said, why do people do horrible things to one another? You know, why? And that's a really big one, but I think it also ties into where, you know, how this affects us at our kind of soul level.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about where would an individual start?
Well, I think, and again, this sounds kind of boring, but it's really actually very complex. I think as individuals, each of one of us needs to start with the absolute basics, and those are typically the ones that we've ignored. Mm-hmm. And in that, we're talking about we live in our bodies. And so the physiological basics, and many people are probably familiar with Bessel van der Kolk, who's a wonderful researcher in this field. And I always loved the title of one of his earlier articles in a later book, which was The Body Keeps the Score. And that is, when we are in these high-stress, trauma-exposed environments, we typically are captured up in our heads and we're responding from our heads to everything that's going on around us. And we often become extremely neglectful. And so starting with the physiological basics, and part of what's exciting, too, about the very recent research is understanding how and why this stuff works. For example, basics around sleep, nutrition, and hydration. And the sleep deprivation story, what we typically find when we're going into the environments we work with, is well over 50% of the folks are chronically and seriously sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. Now, that in its own right has huge consequences for health, for memory, for immune system functionings, concentration, attention. I mean, the story goes on and on. That one is massive. And again, we have to look at all of, there's a whole subset of information underneath that and the ways that we really need to take this one on. The nutrition piece. Most of us are tired, we're struggling, and our diets are pretty shocking, and it's just trying to keep us going. We're not paying attention to it. So again, it's another dysregulating piece physiologically that starts having all kinds of consequences. And then, of course, we look at 50% of us are chronically dehydrated, and we're not drinking enough water. Now, that one becomes particularly prominent in a high-stress environment because we're secreting high levels of stress hormones. And at the physiology level, it's that high concentration of the stress hormones and their breakdown products, which is leading to chronic inflammation across all tissue types and all organ systems. So that's actually physiologically one of the biggest villains in the piece is the high levels of circulating stress hormones. If we're dehydrated, we're really amplifying that pressure. So we all need to be drinking enough water. And that's, it's so basic, but fundamental. The other piece, too, is, when we look at the physiological basics, is the exercise story. Mm-hmm. And, sort of yada, yada, yada. We all know that one. But, in fact, the reality of it, in terms of recent research, is not only is it a really important way of sort of maintaining overall level of cardiovascular fitness, et cetera, that sort of thing, and discharging some of the stress, but the new story in terms of neurotrophic growth hormone. When we exercise, we secrete neurotrophic growth hormone. That is the growth hormone that leads to the growth and replacement and repair of nerve cells. And that's where all these recent studies coming out looking at individuals in the 50 and plus range. And if they were getting 45 minutes of exercise, and that's just brisk walking, at least three times a week, it was cutting the risk of dementias by over 50%. And, of course, this research is extended and going across lifespan, and, of course, it's why we want little kids to be active and on and on. So, again, we start coming into these basic ones. And then also our ability to take the temperature down, learn to induce the relaxation response, not always to be sort of tweaking up here in the high stress range. So those just physiological basics, absolutely central.
There's a wonderful new resource that I'm sure you know about, but I want to recommend to our folks who are listening, which is a wonderful book called The Telomere Effect by Elizabeth Blackburn. Nobel Prize winner, looking at DNA and so on. And it's just, I just finished reading it, and I found it extremely easy to read as well. So I just want to add that piece, the telomere effect. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
Absolutely. I absolutely echo that. It's a wonderful book. And then the next piece, levering it up a bit more, is, you know, the critical issue around social supports and balance in our lives. And, you know, we all know that what we can start getting into is life can start constricting to all work and then go home and do the absolute necessary basics. We start losing our friendships. We're not socially active. Our lives become increasingly unbalanced. So it's sort of moving and pushing that back out, because at the end of the day, you know, our work is really important, but it isn't our life. It needs to be embedded inside of our full life. And in sort of looking at all of those issues, what are we doing there? And then when we're in our work, we tend to get, because we're stress elevated, we're so focused neurologically on, you know, sort of crisis management. What's going wrong? Where's the danger? So we're hypervigilant around what's the negative news in our environment. And, you know, we're shutting down on frontal lobe functioning, actually, and we're moving into sort of crisis management, you know, fight or flight sort of response. So when we take the temperature down and we start recruiting our full frontal lobe, we really need to be looking at what's all the good news. What have we done right? What are the positive and valuable outcomes of the work we've been doing? Because typically, when we're in that stress elevated state, we're not even registering that. So again, re-embedding ourselves in the value of the work that we're doing, because we came into this work for a really good reason. And so being able to come back into that. And then again, looking at all of the social kinds of supports and connections that we have inside of our workplace, our relationships with our colleagues, you know, all of that is so central. And so, you know, those three are sort of a really basic place to kind of start with. And obviously there are a host of other ways we can start looking at it. And again, in the book, what I'm trying to do is give people an opportunity to find how they intersect with this and where are the areas that they absolutely have some real strengths, because we have to be strength-based in this. And then given our strengths, what are our challenges and what are the most practical and adaptive ways for us to start addressing those? And then start looking at how do we overcome some of our internal barriers and external barriers around doing that, and stay inside of our zone of control.
I love what you're saying, and that's what I find so exciting about the work that we do, is that there are a lot of different entry points. And we just got a wonderful question that kind of brings it to a level that I'd love to kind of have an exploration with you. This basically says, the question says, I'm wondering whether you've seen any social science that tackles how workers fundamentally self-identify and how the rigidity of identifying as the helper may impact burnout and fatigue. What are your thoughts about that, about identity and how invested we become in that?
Yes, and I think that's a wonderful question, and essentially it starts to be even entering into kind of an existential realm here.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of what can start informing answers to that question are the various pathways that we come to doing this work. One of the things we do know is that a very high proportion of people who are in the helping professions come themselves from some pretty difficult backgrounds and trauma histories themselves. And so many of us have come into this work because we want to be helpers. In the event that we have had a chance to kind of really examine that and work that through and had an opportunity to do some of our own work around this stuff, I think that we can be much more informed and self-caring around it.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, though, for some of us, we haven't had a chance to really do that or taken that opportunity, sometimes the drive can be so much in opposition to what we've lived through. And that's one thread, certainly not the biggest thread of everybody, but I think it's certainly a significant thread that we need to think about, was what brings us to this work and how does that fit with our own lived histories. I think we also need to think about the extraordinary messages that we tend to get from our work environments. Some work environments, are so much more literate around all of these issues and mm-hmm. have normalized the effects of the stress, and we can talk about it, we can deal with it. And that's a very different work environment than one of the ones that we still have on the other side of the fence, where it is so divorced that we are the helpers, there can't be anything wrong with us, the people who have a problem are the recipients of our service.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like there's this giant sort of black and white barricade one side or the other. And in those environments, the messages that we're getting, if we have any kind of impact, are so negative. And the messages about being everything to everybody, and that, there's no sacrifice too great, and that's the noble cause, is very, very difficult for people to deal with.
Especially when we're in a context where
being challenged.
Really vulnerable. We only have 2 minutes left before I have to wrap up. I just want to say that before I start talking about it. You and I get those questions a lot, especially for folks who work with extremely vulnerable population, children and youth.
Yeah.
People who work in foster care will say to us, what do you mean take care of myself? Don't you understand that if I don't do the 12-hour shift or if I don't do the overtime, this child may, fill in the blank. So what would you say to that?
Well, I think, again, I just come back to, in many ways, the foundation of first you have to put the oxygen mask on you first.
Mm-hmm.
And, none of us, and I think one of the hard, hard parts about working in many of the fields that we work in is that there are a lot of enormously deserving, highly vulnerable people who need our help, mm-hmm. typically more than we are able to provide for. And so that becomes not only a deeply personal issue in terms of how we're responding to that, but it also becomes an existential question, a social question, a public health question. I mean, there's so many ways that this is playing out.
Mm-hmm.
And, we know that all of the work around that piece. So in some ways, we have to titrate and look at how well can I be helpful here without destroying myself,
mm-hmm.
And doing great harm to myself? And then what are the consequences, not only to me, but often to the people that we love who are back home? And so as we get into more trouble, our capacity to be present for other people for whom we have, deep relationships becomes a real issue. So it's, in so many ways, again, we come back to things like really good peer support, really good practice groups where we can support each other around these realities and what can we actually do and what is legitimate. And how do we tolerate, in many ways, working in fields that contain a lot of good news and also genuine tragedy?
Absolutely. That's so well said. I need to stop you there. Because we're almost out of time. And I want to bring up a couple of things for our folks who are listening. If you're interested, this discussion that Pat and I are having is also something that is discussed in a free article that I wrote a couple of years ago that's available on the website, and it's called Beyond Kale and Pedicures. And it has a long discussion. In fact, I interviewed Pat for the article as well, where we have a conversation about kind of the ethics and the ethical responsibility that we all have to actually take good care of ourselves in order to be able to do this challenging work. But what I really appreciated, Pat, from the book and also just the conversations and the work that we have and that we do is that the resources you're offering are realistic and it gives an entry point, and I think that's so important. So just to wrap up, I'm going to bring up a couple of quick things and then we'll be done. If folks who are listening to this call enjoyed this, and I'm aware that some of you were not able to log on, and we think it's actually your firewall, and so we're going to, these recordings will be available. If you're interested in having another Q&A, please send us some questions. Just email us. Our email address is info@tendacademy.ca. If you'd like us to do another webinar, I think Pat and I would really enjoy doing that on a semi-regular basis. Send us our questions, and we will look into doing that. And now, dum-dum-dum, for the book draw. what we did is we used a random number generator. And so I promise you this was done blind and completely fair. And the winner of the free copy of Pat's book, Resilience, Balance, and Wellness, is Susan Poste, or Post, I'm not sure, P-O-S-T-E, Susan. Congratulations to you, whether you're listening to this call live or in a recording. We will have our assistant, Kelly, get in touch with you, and we will ship a copy of the book to you. Obviously, if you're interested in accessing or purchasing the book or anything else, please go to our website, and you can find it there. I want to finish by reminding you that we have an annual Compassion Fatigue Conference called Care for You. It is being held in June, on June 23rd, 2017, in Toronto. And if you're interested in that, also go to our website. Thank you so much, Pat. I wish you the best from across the country.
Oh, thank you, Francoise. As always, it's a great delight when we get to go over all of these things. We can talk for hours.
We sure can. So
thank you so much. Yes.
And
be
well.
Everyone who's listening.
And we'll be in touch shortly. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye.